Good evening, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Highbury to the Grove. It's the third episode, and if you missed last week's episode, you missed a great chat with Clive Palmer, co-host of the Arsenal Vision podcast and generally considered to be the conscience of the Arsenal fan base. But this podcast, as always, is a respite from the wins and losses, a break from tactics and talking points, just good old-fashioned fun, chats, and banter with some of the most recognizable faces within our great Arsenal family, telling their stories, sharing their views, and answering your questions. So join us now as we travel from Highbury to the Grove. Everybody, and welcome back to Highbury to the Grove. If you missed last week's episode, like I said, we had a great chat with Clive Palmer, talked about his upbringing, his football education, the acceptance and comfort level that really led to him becoming an Arsenal supporter, his least and favorite moments as a supporter, the impact and responsibility that comes with being so visible within the fan base, and what the Arsenal community has brought into his life. If you missed it, it's not too late to catch the episode on demand on YouTube, so make sure you go to the Highbury Squad or the Gooners Pod channels to check it out. Tonight, however, we are thrilled to welcome another special guest into the studio from the Arsenal community. We are thrilled to welcome in a man who not only played for the Arsenal for eight glorious years, has established himself as a top-tier commentator for the Premier League and the Champions League in the UK. We will not call him a pundit because he doesn't like that word, but he's been introduced to millions and millions of younger fans who never had the chance to see him play as a player, but identified him as one of the voices of their favorite football video game. He's also written a phenomenal book, an autobiography called Heads Up in 2019. He, thanks to Gunners.com for the thumbnail here, has 347 appearances for Arsenal, 115 goals, 35 assists, two First Division championships, one FA Cup, one League Cup, one Cup Winners' Cup, and two Golden Boots. Of course, we are talking about the one and only Alan Smith. Alan, thank you so much for being with us, and welcome to our new series.
Yeah, good to be here, Mike. Yeah, lovely. Love it.
So it's always great to see you today. Of all days, now I'm not talking about the live table, but have you taken a look at the football table recently for the Premier League? And can you tell me where we are in that table?
Where are we in the Premier League table?
Not the live table, because I understand there was a fluky goal about 20 minutes ago that might have changed it. But
yeah. No, we're top, aren't we? As they were singing last night against Luton. But yeah, Sheffield United actually could have scored a couple of goals before Liverpool scored there, couldn't they? So there you go.
Tell us how you're feeling. I mean, we're eight games left in the Premier League season. This is where things kind of started to go wrong for us last year. Not to bring a downer to it, but things seem a little bit different this time.
Yeah, I mean, from an injury point of view, Mike, all things, touch wood, seem good. I mean, last night was all about getting the 3 points and avoiding injury, which seemed to be the case. Saliba's in majestic form. making the game look ridiculously easy. And as we all know, we missed him dreadfully last season when he got injured. Gabriel, I don't think he's played better in an Arsenal shirt. He's really got the bit between his teeth. So those two giving the team a fantastic platform. They really are. It's looking good. Certainly, we're a better team than we were last year because of that extra defensive resolve. Fingers crossed, it's tight, isn't it? It's extremely tight, but we've just got to keep winning.
Yeah, there's not going to be many nails left for any men or women who are just biting them right now. But, I'm excited for the run-in. So we're starting out with about 150 people in the live chat right now. Here's how it works. We appreciate you joining us. Starting now and throughout the show, if you have any questions, we'll call them questions for the guest that you would like to ask Alan, this is your opportunity. Put them in the chat as early as you can with a capital G to start it out for questions. And we will spend probably 20 minutes or so at the end of the show going through some of the better questions and asking Alan and getting the answers. So please take a moment as well, as Tammy will tell you, to hit the like button, show us some love. Doesn't take that long. So I wanted to start out with something that you are very well known for, Alan, and that is this thing. Anyone who watched you play throughout your career comes away calling you one of the best headers of the ball in the game, past or present. I saw a statistic somewhere, and I don't know how accurate it is, but it said that you scored 162 goals in the Football League, not including, you know, cups and European competitions, and 98 of them were headers, which is over 60%. Is it possible that that is true?
That doesn't sound right to me, mate. I mean, you saw it.
It wasn't a reputable source, but I tried to find some statistics on that, but I don't know. I saw
never done the maths. I mean, I've never counted them. I was good in the air. I mean, I'm tall, so it was something that I practiced. Obviously, you try and make the most of your advantages, don't you? But yeah, I don't think it was that many headers.
Not everybody though. You know, not even every tall player is good with their heads. I mean, so I wanted to ask, like, in your early training and youth football and all of that, was it something that you took extra work on, or was it just that people were lumping crosses into you because you were tall? Were you always taller than the other kids? Did you tower over defenders?
I was actually taller than the other kids. I remember playing for my primary school when I was about 9, perhaps. It goes up to 11 in England, and we were winning about 8 or 9 nil, and I'd scored about 7 of them. But I was a lot taller than the other kids, and one of the dads from the other side was going, "Get him off, he's older than all these kids, it's not fair, get him off." And my dad had to put him right, say, "No, he's the same age, he's the same age as your boy." I don't know where it came from, the height. My dad actually was quite short, and my mum. So I'm not sure where it came from. My brother's fairly small, but I didn't go out of my way to practice. I would not say, you know, as you become a professional, you do crossing practice. So, you know, you're getting a fair amount of headers when you're doing that. But it was just something that I was good at. The timing of the jump is everything. And when I got to Arsenal as well, because George Graham was a very good header of the ball, as he constantly used to tell us when he was a player, and he used to give me a few lessons on the art of heading.
Now, the art of crossing, I mean, we all talk about how, you know, a guy like, you know, James Ward-Prowse, for example, is known internationally for how good of a striker of the ball on a set piece or a corner or just a cross. I mean, he's not known to be an exceptional player, but he's really good at that. So are there players that you played with, either at Leicester or of course with Arsenal, that were just above the rest when it came to just putting it right where it needed to be? How important is the cross in a header? Obviously, it's got to be on target, but are there, you know, leading you by a certain amount of bend? I've always wondered, you know, is there kind of a, you know, a telepathy between the person who's crossing and the person who's going to go for the header, or am I overthinking it?
No, if there's an understanding between the person out wide and the person in the middle, well, then you've got a great advantage knowing when that person out wide is going to put it in. There's nothing worse than thinking, oh, he's checked back, and you're making runs trying to get ahead of your man. And then you've got to make another run. Lee Dixon was a good cross for the ball, roving up that right-hand side from right back. He could cross it. I had a good relationship in the 88-89 season with Brian Marwood. Hmm. Now, Brian on the left wing, he was right-footed. And he would quite often not even beat his man, his fullback, but he'd just duck inside and he'd whip a ball in with his right foot. And as soon as he's ducked inside, I was ready to go. And so whether it came to my head or my feet, you know, quite often it was to my feet, but you knew when the ball was coming in. So that, I think that's vital in that relationship. You know, Brian, he didn't overcomplicate his game like some wingers can.
He didn't do 27 step overs like Anthony and then you had to
exactly
sit in there and figure out when he was going to finally cross.
he didn't do all that. And it meant that we had a really good relationship and I knew what he was thinking. He knew where and when I wanted it. So that was particularly good, I think.
Note to self, sometimes simpler is better.
Simple game.
Who would you say, and you know, there's one person I think everybody has the tip of their tongue, but not named Olivier Giroud, who were the top headers in the game that you see today?
Who were the top headers in the game?
Yeah, someone who basically, knows exactly the pace, can snap that neck, and you're either good at it or you're not, and there are certain players, I think, that are just known as being better. And in all the games that you see from commentary, is there anyone that comes to mind?
I mean, there's a few defenders, to be fair, you know, that do really well at set pieces. People like Tarkowski at Everton. I mean, I know they're struggling, but he's one of those that the ball seems to be a magnet when a corner or a free kick comes in. He gets his head to the ball. I mean, Haaland's obviously very good, and he's got that advantage of being taller than everyone else, stronger than everyone else. And when Kevin De Bruyne is whipping in those superb crosses, he's always going to be favourite. It isn't such a prevalent art these days, is it? Because there's so many more cutbacks along the deck than there used to be, maybe. But there's still nothing better than seeing somebody rise at the far post. Gabriel's done it from some corners, hasn't he? He scores some goals. He loves it. You've got to want to attack it, haven't you? You've got to want to get your head to the ball. So many people don't really want to do it, and you can see it when they do attack the ball. Not quite so many, but there'll always be a place in the game, I think, for that kind of skill.
Yeah, and it's being taught less and less at the youth levels, I think, because of concerns. We won't go too deep into that, but yeah, it's fun it's fun when your team scores one from a header. But something not as fun is a little bit more sad as well. But you know, last Sunday was not only a massive day for Arsenal, keeping Man City to a clean sheet and showing that we belong in this title chase. But it was also a somber day of remembrance for someone who also played for Man City for a brief time, but was the very definition of the Arsenal way. And it's someone that you and I have spoken about at length. You've written about him in your book. An all-time great who was a 10 out of 10 as a footballer and a 50 out of 10 as a human being. So, we are, of course, talking about David Rocastle. Like I said, we've spoken to each other about Rocky on multiple occasions, but we have somewhat of a new audience, a lot of people who may not have seen those. So can you tell our audience a little bit about how Rocky impacted your career, your arrival at the team, and how he and his family impacted you personally?
Yeah, the first time I'd seen him on the telly, actually. I remember a feature on him. He was living in the south of London where he was brought up, and it was his route via the tubes left, right, snaking up through London, over the Thames and to Highbury, where he had to be for about 8:30 every morning. He was obviously a player of promise, and I was looking at him. I think, oh, he looks like a good lad. But we went to Penny and I once with Penny, my wife, and I once we joined Arsenal in the summer of 87. There was an end of season dinner in London. I don't know why. It seems a curious thing because we didn't have any after that, I don't think. But there was an end of season dinner, probably for charity, with all the Arsenal lads and some supporters. And I was on a table. I think Graham Ricks was there with his wife and one or two others. And then this young lad walked across, introduced himself. Hello, my name's David Rocastle. Welcome to the club. You know, it's lovely to have you here. If there's anything you need, just ask, you know. I just remember he was so well-spoken, Rocky, as well. So well-spoken and polite. And he's walked away, and I've said to my wife, what a nice lad he is. And he was so young, and it was that maturity that he would come across and be so nice and so helpful. And that was my first impression of him, and that impression never went away. He was such a nice lad, one of those that everybody in the dressing room loved. They just loved Rocky. And, of course, on the pitch, he was a star. He was... so skillful and so brave. He could mix it physically, couldn't be intimidated. He had some great battles with Stuart Pearce, who was playing for Nottingham Forest, and he just loved that physical side. He would never back down, but his feet were so quick. And talking across us, you know, he could whip in a lovely ball. But we became really close friends, as we did with Janet, his wife, and got three lovely... We're not kids anymore. Melissa, Ryan and Monique. I was at the Luton game last night and I was with them. We did an interview pitch side with them, and we had a good catch up afterwards. So really strong as a unit. You know, we regard them as family, really, the Rocastles. But Rocky was, he was a bit different. I know when people pass away, everybody's brilliant, aren't they? But he was a bit different, Rocky. He just stood out a little bit for whatever reason.
You mentioned family. I mean, we at the beginning of, I think it was 2021, maybe. It was about 3 years ago. We did a podcast with Ryan Rocastle, and I brought you on kind of as a surprise to him. And the first thing he said was, "Oh, Uncle Alan."
Yeah. Uncle Smudge.
I melted when he said that, because, I mean, you know, having lived through and watched that era, you know, you were just all icons to me. I was a 15-year-old kid watching a bunch of guys in their 20s and some in their late teens just do magic on the pitch, and never, you know, never thinking I'd get to know anybody on a personal level. But I just always imagined that there was this camaraderie and closeness and, you know, this chemistry amongst you. But I mean, to the point where, you know, 35 years, 33 years later, you know, Uncle Alan, it's wonderful. And I've gotten to see Janet and Monique and Ryan. I haven't met the other sister yet.
Melissa,
but just an absolutely lovely family. And it just, you know, it all starts at the top with the two parents. And I've heard that David's brothers are also really fine people. One of them played in the States, I think, for a little while. He's just, I mean, he's my answer to who my favorite player is of all time, mostly because of the person he is, but also just getting to see that quality. The Brazilian who was English from South London, it's fantastic. And his statue is the one that needs to go next, I think, on that concourse. Him and maybe... You could have Wrighty and him together because of their special bond that they had, but them, then you. Speaking of team chemistry, though, we've heard about the chemistry of the late 80s squad, the Tuesday Club, the characters on the team, good mix of kind of young and up and coming players, many of whom were brought in from, you know, from the lower divisions, along with the grizzled veterans, as we would say, of the game. David O'Leary and Paul Davis and otherwise. With a coach like George Graham, who comes across as really being a disciplinarian, a taskmaster, very, very driven in some ways, it's very, very similar to what we see from Mikel Arteta. Was there a culture of fear in the locker room, or was, you know, with of consequences, or was it really a brotherhood and a tight-knit group or somewhere in between?
Oh, no, there was an element of fear, I suppose, with the gaffer and respect. You know, when you saw him jogging around the corner at London Colney onto the training pitch, you went, oh, right, here's the gaffer. You know, when we were having a warm-up in the early days with Theo Foley, we'd mess about a little bit. But then when the gaffer appears, you didn't mess about quite so much. And he always turned up for training. That was the thing about George. He rarely missed a day. He loved to be out on the training ground. But these were the times when managers could and did rule with fear. Obviously, you know, dropping players, making them train with the youth team, Paul Davis being a big example of that when he fell out with George and he was away from the first team for 18 months, 2 years or something, massive amount of time. Yeah. Obviously, you can't do that now with players, with them being such big earners, high earners. But then you were at the mercy of the manager a little bit more. And so that brings the fear into a little bit. You know, you don't want to get the wrong side of him. But by the same token, he was good at handling players. He treats certain players differently according to their personalities. But yeah, he was a hard taskmaster. He pushed you. Because he always used to say, you know what, when I've seen your best, I want you to get very close to that every day of the week and every Saturday. So, he pushed, but he was good on the training, good tactician, as he showed in Europe as well, especially, really.
So it wasn't just intensity for intensity's sake, because you were able to see the fruits of what he was trying to do. And I guess that's, you know, to make a correlation to the current team, you know, if you're buying into the project and you have to watch your step and you have to make sure to not fall afoul of the famous non-negotiables. If you don't really see where the football is headed, then that's going to rub you the wrong way. But if you see where the football is headed, you buy into it. And from what you've seen from this current squad, would you say that chemistry and that belief is the biggest thing that's propelling them to where they are now?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think Arteta maybe is the easiest manager to work under, because, you know, he will be pushing the boys all the time. But as you say, Mike, when you see results, it is hard work. But if you see results at the end of the day, you do buy into it and you will give your all. And you want to be part of it. You know, you don't want to drop out of the starting 11. You can sense that the team, the club is going places as we could. And you want to be in the manager's thoughts. You know, Unai Emery, I think, was somebody that pushed the lads. And as he's showing now at Villa, as he's shown many times over in Spain, he's a very, very good coach. It wasn't quite the right fit at Arsenal at that time. You know, he's one that would ask you to sit down and watch hours of footage, you know, video analysis and that. And some players buy into it, others don't. But no, I think whatever the manager's methods, if it works, and if you feel personally that he's making you a better player as well, I mean, that's a big thing, because players are selfish. They want to become better. If you feel he's doing you good, then certainly you'll respect him as a coach.
And I think that also can work in reverse, hopefully not for many, many years in our case, but you see situations like Leicester City when they won the league, and then a couple years later, the way they kind of regressed under Ranieri. I think once that intensity is not producing results, once the players are maybe confused or there's just not that level of success, it can turn bad. You start to see down tools and that sort of thing. I think what's been built here is sustainable. It's visually to the players, rewarding them for learning the system. And I mean, long may it continue.
Yeah, I mean, They're young, aren't they, as well? They're still young, the lads, and most of them haven't won anything in the game up until now. So there's the hunger there, as we had. They're not kind of a jaded bunch of footballers that have
True.
won things, and you're gonna have to keep pushing them. I mean, this is why Guardiola is such a genius of a coach. You know, he's got these lads that have won multiple titles, Champions League and that, but he's still got ability to keep pushing and keep the hunger in those players. But yeah, our boys at the moment, they all want to achieve and do it together, and they can see the possibilities of that.
Yeah, I think there's a certain kind of manager or leader of men that we see in sports all over the world that are probably better at what you've just described, Pep Guardiola doing, Phil Jackson in basketball, Bill Belichick in football, in American football, Ancelotti probably another good example in world football. You wonder how they'll do if you ever get the chance to see them with a team that has less talent, less experience, less winning. And I think we did see a snippet of that with Ancelotti at Everton. And it doesn't quite go well, but there's a ability to get young players to play above their station, to buy into a process. I think that's what Arteta has. You've seen some other coaches, maybe a Brendan Rodgers, who, Unai Emery, to get players to play above their station. Maybe not get over that hump to the top of the top, but it's interesting how different types of coaches appeal to different types of players and different situations. Just my observation.
Well, it's knowing personalities, knowing people. I think Alex Ferguson was brilliant at that.
Of course. I mean,
Yeah, and he
he
always
transcends either one of those things. I think he could have whipped any.
people have him down as the hairdryer and old school manager, but I think one of the lads told, I think it was Ryan Giggs, told a story about if he wanted to have a go at somebody, but he didn't think he could take it. He'd have a go at, say, Ryan Giggs, who was sat next to him. He'd absolutely hammer Giggsy, knowing that there'd be a bit of a fallout. The message would get across to the lad who was next to him, who might have been a little bit more fragile. But I mean, it's absolutely brilliant psychology, and he was a master at that. And he adapted as football changed over the years, and that's a heck of a skill to be able to do that. But that, you're not, I'm not sure you can learn that. That's got to be in you. That, to know how to treat different players like that, to know their personalities, to know what's going on in their lives. They're all people at the end of the day. So some managers ignore that side, the personal side of players' lives. Others don't, and I think you've got to know what's going on, because it's all up here, isn't it?
The obvious question, I mean, it seems like footballers tend to, among other things, business interests and that sort of thing, go into commentary or coaching. Those are probably the two most visible post-career occupations or vocations that you can do. Was coaching ever in your thoughts? Was coaching ever something you had interest in doing, or was it always broadcasting in
No,
nature?
well, I didn't know what I was going to do, but I was pretty sure I didn't want to be a coach when I finished, because the end came fairly quickly. But I did some Arsenal soccer schools when I first retired. Alan Sefton, who was head of community, said, "Oh, it'd be nice, just way of ticking over." And I organised them in some schools locally to where I was. But I never had that urge to get out on that pitch and, tell them what's what, and to get my ideas across as a coach. So I knew, even from doing soccer schools, that wasn't for me. Some lads are the opposite. They just take to it and they love it. It would be a big mistake to do it because there was nothing else to do, because you'd fail at it. But yeah, I didn't. I knew that that wasn't what I was going to do. And then the media stuff built up gradually. The writing and the TV stuff, and
You know,
yeah.
I watched a great interview recently of you with Talk Sport, I think, or not Talk Sport, sorry, Sky Sports, about 4 years ago, talking about kind of mental health and how, when your career ends, especially if it ends a bit earlier than you would have liked due to injury, as was the case with yours, how important it is to, really look after yourself, your your mind, your, you know, and find a passion and find an interest. And, you know, you kind of described how you started, you took some classes, I think, for writing. You wrote for the Telegraph. Was it the Telegraph?
Yeah. I started with the Evening Standard. Well, no, I beg your pardon. I started with the Ham and High, the Hampstead and Highgate, which had an Arsenal column. And then the following year, I started with the Standard. And then I did a regular one for the Telegraph. Yeah. So it built up that way. But writing those weekly columns for the Arsenal columns, it was a real good discipline. Sometimes you're sitting down when you're new to it and you think, God, what am I going to write about today? But you have a little chat to the editor and some people, and then ideas come into your head. And the more you do it, the less you need that help. You kind of quite naturally get hold of a theme and develop it.
Yeah, my favorite part of that interview as well was you had mentioned, you know, in when you left the club, it was right at the beginning of a new season.
Yes.
I think right when Bruce Rioch had arrived and yeah. you were in and around the team on the first day of the season. And as you were leaving, someone else was coming through that had just been brought to the team. You had a quick handshake and wished him good luck. Whatever happened to that guy?
Yeah, that's exactly right. It was the first day of pre-season, and somebody said, "Oh, Bruce Rioch wants to see you to have a chat." I had to pick up my boots anyway, but as it turned out, Bruce didn't say a lot to me. He just said hello. But I've gone in there, and all the lads, you know, coming in first day of pre-season, and there's the new boy. I've shaken his hand, Dennis Bergkamp, wished him all the best. It's up to you now, son. Do what you can. You know, I couldn't wait to get out of there, really. Could not wait to get out, because they'd all got a purpose. They were all thinking about the season. They got a new manager to impress. You know, they had their issues, and I was outside that circle. I was, you know, just like that. You're outside the circle. You're not one of them anymore. And as sympathetic as they are, you're outside. You're an outsider. So I just wanted to get out and drive home, and that was it. You know, and I think most players will tell you that, because they always say, "Oh, I'll pop back to the training ground and see us, come in for a cup of tea and all that." But no, it's not right. It doesn't feel right, and no, I think most players will say that.
If you break up with a girl, you don't want to watch her on television every single day for the rest, you know, right away. I guess it's you know, there's a healing time. So not to make that kind of comparison and act like it's equivalent, but we've got just under 300 people in the chat right now. Remember, if you haven't given a thumbs up, please do. It helps the channel. Subscribe to the Highbury Squad, subscribe to the Gooners podcast, and throughout the show, we've gotten some good questions in already. It's not too late. Start with a G and ask a question, and we will probably get started with those in about a little over 5 minutes or so. So next, a lot of player chants have taken form this season. We're seeing new chants come up, and frankly, they've been created by some folks I know. Some of them from Dan and Fergus, who's in the chat, and the rest of the guns and yellow ribbons. But the Gabrielle chant, the Odegaard chant. Last year, we had a few new ones with Saliba. I have asked, because I don't remember. I was 15 then. Did you have your own personal chant?
Oh, it was boring. It was so boring.
I'm not going to ask you to sing it, but can you speak it? Because it might jog my memory then.
But it was like Alan Smith, Alan Smith, Alan Smith, Alan Smith, Alan Smith, and it kind of built to a crescendo, and it was Alan Smith, and then at that point I'd clap, you know. So it was one of the worst. My name's not an easy one too.
So it's one of those where the tune is used for multiple chants.
They're a bit more creative now, the fans, aren't they? I think with chants, they are. Well, they're a lot more creative. I don't hear most of them because, you know, when I'm at a game, I've got my cans on and I'm concentrating on the match, so I don't really hear these songs. But yeah, it's great, isn't it? It's great when, and I think the lads love it. If there's a good song attached to them, they're going to love that.
You hear stories of them like singing, you know, of Saka singing Saka and Emma Smith Rowe in the dressing room, and just, I mean, they're little, like, what do they call them, earworms or something like that. Once they get in, the first time I saw the new Gabrielle song, it was in writing because, frankly, the people that wrote it put it into a chat and I was looking at it and I'm like, that's really complicated. There were like 8 different lines and they were all different. Like I'm like, that's not going to catch on. Then I came over to England. I went to 2 or 3 straight away games where, you know, you're just chanting the entire time. Away supporters, unbelievable. And it was just infectious. Like I was singing it in my sleep after that. So good job to the crew that's making up these songs. Social media, I'm sure, has a lot to do with them spreading and kind of becoming known. You know, if in the old days, if you just stood on the North Bank by yourself and belted out a new song that you'd written, no one else knows the words. You're probably gonna annoy people more than you were gonna get it to go viral or whatever the equivalent of it that was in those days. But all right, so you did have a chant though. I think I kind of remember that. So
yeah. Yeah, I had a slightly different one at Leicester. It was, he's here, he's there, he's every doo-doo-where, Alan Smith. Used to be, not before the watershed, that one. But yeah, that was the one at Leicester.
That's fantastic. So we've talked about the environment within the dressing room, but the atmosphere. This podcast is obviously called From Highbury to the Grove. You know my history of growing up watching Arsenal in Highbury and now watching them in the Emirates. And I think most fans who have been to both places can describe the difference between the two and the sentimentality. But you were at the game on Tuesday. Now, I've heard Tuesday was a bit of an outlier between midweek evening trains, rain and whatnot, but you've been in the gantry quite a bit, probably before and after you have your cans on. Have you noticed a difference, and how does it kind of compare with 60,000 people all around the stadium compared to the old Highbury setup?
Well, yeah, I mean, the atmosphere, as everybody says, is brilliant these days. It has been for a year or two, hasn't it? We had some friends over from Australia who were English, but they went over in 2004. My mate's a massive Luton fan, so that's why I wanted to go to the game. And his son's an Arsenal fan because of me. but we sat down up behind the goal, the North Bank end, and the game kicked off, and Martin, my mate, said, "Oh, What a great atmosphere it is here." You know, first 5 minutes and the fans were singing, it hit him. You know, there was a little buzz, tension in the air. And I mean, look, the Luton game really wasn't the best example of that, was it? Yeah. Because it didn't really take off that much. But, yeah, to have it how it is now. I read on social media today, I think it was, they're on about, you know, this day in 88, I think it was, we beat Norwich 2-0, scorers Perry Groves and Alan Smith in front of 19,000 fans, because we'd drawn 4 on the trot. Fans weren't all that excited. And 19,000 turned up at Highbury. And it's easy to forget those days.
Do you remember what happened in that same fixture a year later?
I think when that was the little argy bargy.
Yeah. And I was so upset at that, because that game my mother did not allow me to go to. I think that was shortly after. Was that shortly after? No, that was the following year. There was something that I had done wrong and I was grounded and I couldn't go to the game. And it wasn't even on television, of course, as 3 o'clock games are still not on television. But when I saw the highlights, I think on BBC later, you know, I'm like, I missed 5 goals, or was it 5-3 or something like that? And a 4-3, fight.
4-3, I think, yeah.
4-3 and Hargy Bargy all over the place. I'm like, this is like the greatest game for a fan. And of course, it all happened in front of the North Bank as well. But anyway, that, yeah, I mean, 19,000 at Highbury. I mean, Highbury has so much memories for so many people, but, you know, it wasn't always what it could be and was on certain, you know, in certain days. Do you miss the place? I mean, how do you ever go back? Have you been in? Would you like to go?
Yeah, you've been there, I believe. I mean, yeah, it was. I was saying to my friend the other night, there's no other ground that's been retained like that, is there? Obviously, because of the listed stands, no other ground that's been turned into an apartment complex. I don't know if there will be moving forward. Obviously, Liverpool have stayed where they are. Old Trafford's going to be really developed. They're not going to move sites. I mean, Everton, they're moving down to the docks, down to the Mersey. But I would imagine Goodison Park will be knocked down. But yeah, it was those two stands that are just special that no other club has had. And the way that they did convert it, Mike, you know more than most that it's a beautiful job. But yeah, like anything, we had some bad times there where you turn up and you know the fans aren't behind you. You know it's going to be hard work today. Like, they're not full of optimism. You can't get a win. But obviously there were other days when it was brilliant, absolutely fantastic. I always talk about the League Cup semi-final against Everton, where there were 55,000 and about 10,000 locked out that night. That was an amazing atmosphere. There were other times where you could hear the fans shouting abuse at you because there were empty places in the on the terraces and that, and that's when it's hard to kind of get going as a player sometimes.
Well, and a lot of the stadiums back then had kind of netting, and I mean there was basically a separation between the pitch and the terraces, whether it was a cage kind of thing or netting. Highbury never had that.
No.
And I don't know why some did and some didn't, but I certainly appreciated the fact that Highbury didn't. I mean, you get a very clear view.
I think back to when some players scored and that. I remember when we were Everton and we scored, I think Merce clambered up and onto the advertising thing and he's grabbing hold of the bars that are separating the fans from the pitch and that. But yeah, we never had that, did we?
Fans, no. Yeah. I mean, if there was, it was certainly before 1988. But I don't think I've ever seen.
No, there weren't any. There were never any. But we're a civilized bunch at Arsenal.
Perfect. Yeah, you didn't have to keep us in. We were fine. Yeah. So we've got now 315 in live chat. We're going to go to the question segment now. Again, if you're enjoying this, please give your thumbs up to us on YouTube. Please also make sure you're subscribed to the Highbury Squad and to the Gooners Podcast. You can go to YouTube and search for Highbury Squad, search for the Gooners Pod, and subscribe. The questions segment is brought to you by Zenith Coins. Zenith Coins makes beautiful mementos and pieces. This is the brand new North Bank coin that is available. You can go to www.zenithcoins.com and use code HSN10 for 10% off your purchase and follow at Zenith Coins across all social platforms. I also wanted to mention, because this is episode 3 and I'm in my third different location for doing this podcast in those 3 episodes. So you'll notice a new background. All of the artwork behind me is from the fantastic and amazing Ruth Beck. And if you look at the scroll on the bottom, there is a special offer for Ruth Beck's art. Go to buyruthbeckart.com. All of her artwork is famous Islington, Highbury, stadiums, players, Emirates, just everything that I love about North London is encapsulated. We've even got that famous scene here after, I think this was after 89, of course, and there's tons of different kind of Easter egg things in there. So it's an amazing, amazing work from Ruth. So we appreciate Ruth. So now for some questions, let's see what we have here. This is from Demsec. Kind of covered this a little bit, but how long did it take you to adjust to not playing football? Did we kind of answer that question, or is there a kind of a time frame where at some point you felt more comfortable being around it?
Yeah, I mean, doesn't happen overnight. That summer was a tough one. We went away on holiday and everything, and you're just wondering what the future holds. And then, of course, first day of the season, well, you talk to your old teammates during pre-season, how's it going and everything. Then first day of the season, you turn on the telly and they're trotting out all fit and suntanned, and And that's when you really feel it. I just got my head down and got on with it. I had to leave it behind. It hurts, but I had something. I was lucky. I had something to get my teeth into. The writing at the start, really, and that's the way it went. I had a young family to support, so there was not too much time to feel sorry for yourself. I had to go out there and earn a living, and I did. But a lot of the lads went on. I mean, you look at Tony and Baldy and Dicko, Nigel, those lads went on till about 38, 39. So, you know, I was 32 when I packed up. So it makes it even harder in a way.
Yeah, but you got your foot in the door and you're cruising now. So a question from Christian. How does Alan think his own game would translate to the modern game? What player does he see in world football that exudes similar qualities to his own? We talked about how a lot of people really aren't known for using their head, but that, of course, doesn't define you as a footballer. You were good all around, but do you think you'd fit in the modern game, or have those differences that we talked about a little earlier make it a little harder?
Yeah, no, people always say that, don't they, about the players that used to play, say, in the 80s, 90s, you know, would they fit in? But, yeah, you just adjust, don't you? I mean, if you're a good player, you're a good player. Better training methods, better sports science, better physio work makes you a fitter player, more agile. So, yeah.
I did love your answer, but Liverpool have also just conceded. That's what that was all about there.
So is it 1-1?
It is 1-1 right now. Sorry, oh, wow. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but
No. It's a more technical game now, isn't it? But you know, without blowing my own trumpet, technically I was good. I had a very, very good touch. I worked on it a lot. So from that point of view, it's a quicker game. Pitches are. I looked down at. Down at the Emirates, I said to my mate the other night, I said, "Oh, pitch is struggling a bit, isn't it?" He says, "Yeah, it's a carpet. You know, Kenilworth Road, it's still good, he's ground, but it's not quite like the Emirates." So, you know, that ball zipping across the surface, I would have enjoyed that. So, I think I could have adjusted no problem.
I know the answer to this, but we're going to ask it anyway from Moss. So, Smudger, have you ever had a smudging ceremony? Not sure what he means by that, but why the nickname? It's Moss. It's not a complicated story. But
what's the question?
How did you get the nickname Smudge?
Oh, funnily enough, a lot of people don't really know that, but it's just a nickname for Smith. Whether it's in this, I think probably in the South more than other parts of the country. So when I came down to Arsenal, the lads just started calling it me, I think, after a bit. Because in Leicester, it's a dodgy name for Smith, a nickname. It's Smeggy. And I think I've probably told you this story before, Mike, when it was an England break and me and Tony Adams, we had an off day. It was the Saturday. And we weren't playing. We were probably playing the following Wednesday or something. And we got the chance to go to Watford. Me and Tone went there. We were in a box. And then for the match, you sit outside that box. And Watford were playing Leicester. And the Leicester fans did ever so well. They saw me sat outside this box. And they started singing my name. And they started singing, "Smeggy, Smeggy, give us a wave." And Tony looked at me and went, "What's Smeggy? What's Smeggy?" I said, "Oh, yeah, it's a Leicester nickname for Smith." So since that day, he called me Smeggy. He was the only one, because he was the only one that was there at the time. But
Smudger, new team, new nickname. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
Really was a fresh start for you. So,
yeah, oh, I prefer Smudger.
I think that's the one that needs to stick. The other one, just there's something not right about it.
No.
From, I'm not going to get this right, but Jarn Helgi Magnusson. I'm guessing he's from a Scandinavian country.
Sounds like Iceland to me. I don't know.
Oh, that's true. Question for Alan Smith. Which defender did you find the worst or most difficult to play?
Yeah, it's not an answer, but probably people will be a little surprised, because it was Gary Pallister at Man United. I mean, fine player. But he could kind of match everything I did. He was tall, really good in the air, long legs. It was just difficult to get the better of him. And the brawl at Old Trafford, it started when somebody had played a ball up to me and Pally climbed above me and headed the ball down to Nigel, I think, got on. It was Nigel and McClare and it all kicked off, didn't it? But yeah, Gary Pallister, I never looked forward to playing against him. But there were a few out there, some that you think, oh, yeah, no, I feel I can get the better of him. Others you think, oh, it's going to be a long afternoon.
Yeah. I remember a lot of people talking about Des Walker.
That's a funny one, that. Yeah, you'll never beat Des Walker. But I used to have a good time against him. And when we met up with England, Des would say, oh, I didn't enjoy playing against you the other day, Smudgy, you know. And there was just something, you know, he could run a lot quicker than me. He was quick. But, I used to do okay against him.
That's funny. You know, speaking of England, we have a question from Frankie Mustafa. How do you feel about your England opportunities? I was always struck by the fact that as good as Arsenal were in the late 80s, early 90s, the one World Cup that I was in England for was the 90 Italia World Cup, and there was not a one Arsenal player. Maybe Tony Adams, but not.
No.
I don't think there was a single Arsenal player on the national team. On the England national team, but that is.
We were in Singapore, Hong Kong it was, for an end of season trip. And George Graham said to me, Tony and Rocky, he said, Bobby Robson wants you to go back and take part in a few days training. There's going to be 26 of you. And after a few days, he's going to select his 22-man squad. And so we went back, and you're thinking, he's called us back from the other side of the world. We've got a fair chance of being in this squad. And anyway, we did the training, and then I was sharing a room with Tone. We walking up the corridor of the hotel to breakfast one morning, and Bobby Robson cut us off at the pass, and he dragged Tony away and explained to him, it turned out, that he wasn't going to go, but he thought he'd captain his country later, which he did. And then I found out on the old... the old board, you know, when the paper goes up, and there's the squad.
I were going to say you found out while you're on a Ferris wheel. I'm like, yeah, that's a strange time to find out.
I felt like I was on a Ferris wheel. I was gutted, and it was Rocky as well. Me, Rocky, and Tony.
Four people got cut, and three of them, and all three of you are some.
Well, I think the other one was Dave Seaman. Funny enough, he wasn't at Arsenal though. And then I think he went out there because somebody got injured. But yeah, we couldn't wait to get away. I was gutted when it turned into such a good World Cup. Yeah. But it was all three of us.
That's unbelievable. And the fourth being Seaman, this is coincidental, but
yeah.
But you did get your chance, at some point, something like 12 caps or somewhere 13 caps. Sorry. How did that go for you? Did you have success? Did you enjoy it? What were the scenarios? Friendlies, competition?
Yeah, I played in the European Championships in Sweden in 92 when Graham Taylor was the manager. My England career, I would say, it never really took off. It was play a couple of games, I'll come out. Somebody else got a chance, then I might have another chance. I think with strikers, especially at that level, you need to score a goal or two just to give you that confidence and help you relax. Because I had a few chances in front of goal and I was snatching at them a little bit. I was tense, and I needed to have scored a couple early on to get me going there. Bobby Robson tried to reignite the partnership I had with Gary Lineker at Leicester. And it never quite happened. So it was up and down, in and out. I always enjoyed joining up with England. Not everybody did, the lads that knew they weren't going to play, but I just enjoyed. I loved being there. It was a great honour. But I scored a couple of goals at Wembley, scored in a European qualifier, which, yeah, it was great. But it didn't really take off. my England career.
All right, and we're going to do one more question, and then some final words. I want to apologize to everybody whose questions we didn't get to. Some excellent questions, just not enough time. From Demsec, every family has a Maverick. I don't know about every family. I guess if you don't think your family has a Maverick, you're the Maverick, I guess. But every family has a Maverick. Who was the biggest Maverick you played with, and why?
Well, I suppose Gazza. Yeah, you can't get more of a maverick than him. Shared a room with him, which was a crazy experience. He never went to sleep, never sat still. Just up and down, lived on his nerves.
Crazy that always... he was such a good footballer, though. But just despite all that, I mean, he was, I mean, I know he played for the enemy most of the time when I was there, but... great footballer.
Oh, no. I mean, I was lucky to have played with him for England and trained with him when he was at his peak before his injuries. He was just super quick, over 5 yards or so, really strong. He'd lend you the ball. He always wanted it back, little one-twos. So from that point of view, he was a little bit selfish. It was about him type of thing. He wanted to showcase his talents, which he did brilliantly. But yeah, there haven't been many players about like him over the years. He was a bit of a one-off. I think now he would be looked after better because he did have mental health problems going back to his childhood, and they stayed with him. But we just used to get on with it then, didn't we? Yeah, but he amazing talent and an amazing character, really.
Well, that's probably about the best answer I could think of for that. So it's here where we have to wrap up. But I have a personal story first and just something I wanted to say in front of our 350 live viewers right now. Back in 2019, when we had been podcasting for less than 3 years, and you know, I don't remember exactly how we first met, Alan, but your book was coming out. We were ramping up our Gooners versus Cancer charitable campaign. And you agreed to provide our charity with some signed versions of your book, Heads Up, which we auctioned to raise some money for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. And it just so happened that when the books became available, I was in England with a group of about 70 members of the Arsenal America supporters group on our annual road trip. There was one game a year where we get a bigger allocation of tickets. We had, I mean, hard to believe with the current ticket situation, but at that time, it was a little easier to get 70 tickets in the clock end upper for Arsenal America for one game. And it happened to be an Arsenal versus Leicester City game that you were working commentary for. So we were in communication and you said, well, I'll bring them to the stadium. Our supporters club had a pregame kind of greet the players experience in the car park. And then a picture on the pitch right before, you know, before it got too close to game time. And you met me right at the base of the players' tunnel by the dressing rooms. You handed me a bag of signed books. It was obviously a thrill to meet you. And for some reason, I had the balls to ask you if you could take a moment and walk out to the pitch and join us for the supporters club picture. And you agreed. And I just remember walking out of the tunnel and everyone, 70, 80 people are all assembled on the pitch, ready to take a picture. And I said, anyone mind if my mate Alan crashes the picture? And I don't know if you'd noticed the look on everyone's faces, but it was priceless. And that picture, 4 or 5 years later, still adorns the greeting page of Arsenal America.
Oh, there it is. There it is.
So there you are in the middle. I'm me and my extra 150 pounds is all the way over to the right there, right behind that flag. But that was a special day, and of course, it was the first of many times that you've taken time out of your day and your schedule to, you know, to say hello. And I just, you know, whether we're in Brighton or where I was sweating a little bit or in Fulham on New Year's Eve just a few months ago, or even in Heathrow Airport.
Hey, look at that. You were just having your breakfast, weren't you?
I was having my breakfast. Now, you can see the difference in our professionalism because, you know, the outfits that the two of us fly in. But that was hilarious. I'm glad I happened to check my phone and you saw me coming down an escalator. But the moral of the story is you think sometimes that players and people in the media and all that have a bit of a you know, maybe a nice view of themselves, let's put it that way. and I'm sure some do. But it seems like those that come through the arsenal, and especially you, Alan, just have that special something about them that just makes you a gentleman, someone who's always really just looked out for people who are trying to do good things. And that's what I'm trying to do with our charity. And we appreciate your support, your friendship, everything that that you've meant to myself, my family, and you know, our podcast, but most importantly, our charity over the last 5 years. And I just wanted to say a personal thank you and have people hear about that. So any last words for our Gunnar family? And
no, well, I mean, that's very kind of you to say, Mike. You know, I mean, you do brilliant work for charity, so I'm only too pleased to help if I can. You know, it's a squiggle on a shirt for me just to sign the shirts that you do as well.
Sometimes it's more than that, though.
Yeah, that is true. Yeah.
The other story, there are two of these that in world circulation. One of them was won about 2 years ago. The other is going to be auctioned off within the next 6 months. So if you can imagine a 1989 OA shirt with John Lukic, Lee Dixon, Alan Smith and Michael Thomas's autographs with the famous Brian Moore call, starting with Arsenal come streaming up the pitch. I asked you if this was even a remote possibility. You said, send me the shirts and leave it with me. And about 6 months later, these arrived and I was absolutely blown away. The first one helped us raise well over £10,000, over $12,500 for the Leukemia Lymphoma Society. We hope that the second one will do that. If you want to be involved, just follow Gunnar's V Cancer on Twitter and Instagram, and we'll have information about that. But this was something really, really special, and you didn't have to do this. You really didn't have to do this, and you did. So
no, my pleasure, mate. But no, everybody listening, just say hello and keep supporting the boys. Hopefully, it's going to turn into a very special season. Who knows? They couldn't be doing much more at the moment. So, exciting times ahead, I hope. And I'm sure you'll all be watching and hoping, praying for something good to happen. So, just want to say hello to you all.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for the last hour of your time. And thank you most of all to our amazing chat, 350 in the chat. Great new faces, recognizable faces. We appreciate your loyalty. If this is your first time here, please follow the Gunners Pod and Highbury Squad. We're doing this every Thursday. We'll be back next Thursday with another great guest. And in the meantime, we have taken you from Highbury to the Grove. Thanks for joining us.